ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 83 of the Extra Sequential Podcast, hosted out of Melbourne and Perth, Australia. My name's Mladen, and the other voice you'll be hearing is the Perth End, the Muppet, the one and only Chris. How you going, Chris?
Which Muppet am I? Hello! Yes, hello, gentlemen and ladies. Not necessarily in that order, though today the focus is on the ladies, as well it should be, some would say.
So, like a creepy roller rink in the 1980s, tonight is ladies' night of the Extra Sequential Podcast. Yes. Seriously, though, we'll be talking about some of our favorite female creators, women working in comics, mostly today, it's been nice to go through the list and works, just see how many there are, and it's kind of uplifting to see, you know, how many doing it well, you know, in comics.
Yes.
Because comics are usually referred to as a boys' club thing. So it's nice to see exceptions to that rule. So, yeah, we'll be talking about those later on the show, and I'm excited to do this topic following on from the news and what we've been viewing this week. Chris?
Yes.
Did you view any comic book-related films?
I certainly did, my friend. I saw Dylan Dog, which is based on the old Italian, isn't it? Horror.
It's not that old. It's 80s, 90s, really. So, yeah.
Supernatural kind of a cult investigator played by Brandon Routh or Brandon Routh, the guy who played Superman Returns. I don't know what happened to him, but this film was just someone drained all his charisma. I mean, this Dylan Dog was like an episode of Buffy or Angel. You know, you could kind of tell that it was low budget. And yeah, I was kind of, it didn't get me. I was disappointed, Mladen, disappointed.
Because this is like the second Dylan Dog movie. Well, the first one was Unofficial,
yes,
and it starred Rupert Everett, who actually was who the comic character was designed to look like. I've heard that first movie is really bizarre and out there, and the trailers for this one didn't strike me as anything too adventurous.
No, I think they spent all their budget on the big bad monster at the end. But it could have been a lot funnier and a bit more witty, but it was a kind of, and it had his narration over, so it was kind of like a noir, dark kind of tale, but it wasn't anything surprising or new.
Was Groucho in it? Or his character?
No, yeah, because his sidekick kind of looks like Groucho. Doesn't he get a knock in the head and he's a Groucho Marx impersonator and then believes he's actually Groucho Marx or something in the comics?
Yeah,
so
it's an odd comic.
He does have an assistant played by the guy who played Jimmy Olsen, I believe, in this Superman Returns film, so there's kind of a jump again. But there's like just a photo of the two of them with him dressing up as Groucho Marx on a Halloween. But no, he becomes a zombie and loses his arm.
So you could say they sucked all the life out of this character?
Correct.
What's the other movie you saw, Chris?
Gantz 2. You got me onto these films, so I've watched both of the films based on the manga, the long-running, is it still going? Manga?
Yeah, it's still going, yeah. Long-running, yeah. Hyper-sexy, hyper-violent, yeah.
Yes, the films certainly aren't, really. But, yeah, Gantz 2, perfect.
And so, yeah.
Ending, perfect storm, perfect something. But, yeah, the first one was much better. Apparently the second one kind of deviates considerably from the comic. But, yeah, it was, again, it was just kind of bland. And the first one is good, you know, these guys and girls kind of die and get sucked into this thing and kind of go and shoot aliens and this big black orb telling them what to do. And there's a lot of mystery and sci-fi-ness and drama. But this one, there's just too many characters. It's a bit too much like a soap opera.
Yeah.
There's too much flashing back into the real world, as it were. And it didn't have the same appeal as the first one. I don't know why they changed it.
Yeah,
so
I think it's got something to do with licensing, because the anime series based on this manga also followed up to the same point as the first Gantz film and then deviated and did its own thing. So I'm guessing there's some ownership thing where they had the rights to the manga up to a certain point. That's probably how it works. And the first film was my choice for favorite comic book movie of last year.
It was.
And the second one, the less said about it, the better. I didn't enjoy it either. It's I thought the subway fight scene was well staged, and everything else I could have done without. So,
yes,
yeah, a disappointment.
And,
the first one's worth checking out.
Talking about disappointing comic films, you've got one as well. Let's complete the hat trick.
Yeah, last night I had the chance to watch Melbourne's own Ghost Rider on TV. Now, when I first started watching it, I was like, oh, here we go, just another dumb Nicolas Cage movie, which it is. And then a certain scene where a CG flaming skull man rides his motorcycle onto a bridge, and I'm like, oh, that looks like the footbridge over Ponyfish Island on the Yarra. And then it zooms out, and I'm like, that's Ponyfish Club. Just the signs are blanked out. And then you see the Yarra, and I'm like, this film was... It was filmed in Melbourne. So it goes down in history as one of the great Australian films, really.
Yes, no. But it doesn't have Bud Dingwall or Paul Hogan in it.
It does have the obese short girl from Fat Pizza.
It does. You're right. Yes, with an American accent. It's that's like true. His head was on fire or something, doesn't she say? Talking to a reporter.
See, Nicolas Cage, his performance was pretty on fire, but the CG look of the Ghost Rider was some of the worst I've ever seen in any film. It was horrendous, really bad, like laughably bad. But I just like watching Nicolas Cage laugh maniacally in any film that he's in. He's a fun guy to watch, but he didn't make this film that much more enjoyable. I can't believe they made a sequel.
Yeah, and that's had worse reviews than the first one. It was filmed in Bulgaria, Romania, or one of the nanias.
Nothing about this film made any sense. Things would just happen. Characters would run into each other for no reason. The whole police subplot just disappears. Like, it just makes no sense. Another disappointing film. So three terrible comic book movies. Let's hope this year provides some solace, because I know you're looking forward to The Avengers, which is a little more high profile than any of the ones we mentioned, but yeah.
Correct. Oh, it's going to be a big year, Spider-Man. You've got John Carter's out. It's had good reviews.
Well, I've seen John Carter. The 3D, oh, okay. 3D hurt my face. It's probably the worst 3D experience I've ever had, and it's the theatre's fault, not the film's fault. But it's it can really ruin a film when the 3D things are out of focus. Because I had a headache which lasted for 2 days after seeing the film.
Wow.
Yeah.
So your head was on fire like Ghost Rider.
Mwahahaha. Look into my eyes. That's his thing, right? That's the thing he does. Hey, let's get into the comic book news.
Okay.
Chris, do you mind if I open things up here with a sad note, and then we'll pick things up with funny stories afterwards, you know, sort of evening
out? Yes, well, it's the same thing we did last week, which kicked off some sad news as well, but yes, please continue.
And then a swing into wild humour and silliness afterwards, but the Grandmaster of the Ninth Art, Jean Giraud, a.k.a. Mobius, passed away earlier this month. He was born in 1938, and so he's had quite a long run. He was involved in early Pilote magazine, which was a French comic. You should have seen Asterix and so forth in there. And he was one of the founders of Metal Herlon, and some of his famous creations in there were high concept, visually fantastic science fiction creations, including Azrach and The Long Tomorrow and Blueberry is the other famous one as well.
Yep.
And he's been like kind of a long time passion and interest of mine, especially because his work is, well, not especially, but it's sad that a lot of his work is difficult to get in English. So he's not the big name in the West that he is in France, but he's made it onto the cover of quite a few well-known French newspapers upon his passing. So that kind of shows his importance to the comic medium there. I mean, what's your experience of Mobius, Chris?
Yeah, I'm very unfamiliar with him, I guess, as a lot of mainly Western comics readers would be. I know he's certainly influenced a lot of people. And Marvel is set to release the Silver Surfer story that he did a few years ago now, a couple of decades ago, with written by Stan Lee.
Yeah.
But he was 73 years old, and I didn't realize how much movie concept artwork he did. He did it for Alien, the first Alien, Tron, Willow, The Fifth Element. Ridley Scott that said that his work inspired his designs for Blade Runner. And his work is very kind of Jeff Darrow, Frank Quiley, that kind of hyper-detailed, fantastical. His art, just artistic kind of tributes just poured in the last few days. And, you can kind of – it's very noticeable, isn't it, his art? There's no denying that you won't confuse it with some other artist's work.
He's been a huge influence on so many, and obviously not just in comics. I mean, in films, The Fifth Element by Luc Besson borrows quite heavily from a lot of his work. And I believe he and his writing partner, I think it would have been Dan O'Bannon then, they tried suing in regards to ownership of that film,
yeah,
I remember at some point. But you didn't mention Out of Films, and this is of interest to me because there's a documentary coming out soon about the never-made Dune project.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which would have been directed by Alexander Hodorovsky, I think. Alessandro Hodorovsky, I can't remember now, but it was set to be an insane mind. I was going to say mind F, but I'll say mind screw because that means
okay.
Yeah. But there's a documentary coming out about that. I think next year, so there'll be some, no doubt, some exclusive interviews with him in there. So we'll have one last chance to hear from him, I guess, soon. So, but it's a huge loss for the comics field and. It's just a downer. So many great comic artists and writers have been passing away lately.
Ralph McCoy last week, so let's hope that's it for a while anyway. Mm. Staying with Europe, Judge Dredd is releasing an album.
Now, that's an interesting way to present it. I should, for fans of trip-hop, the awfully named genre, Jeff Barrow, who is a multi-instrumentalist for the group Portishead, who are huge of the Bristol trip-hop scene, he and composer Ben Salisbury are producing a Judge Dredd-themed, specifically, what's the city they're in? I can't remember now. Mega City One. Yeah, they're releasing an album, a concept album based around that called Drock, which is like the all-purpose swear word, kind of like frack or smeg. That's used in those comics. So they've written it over a 6-month period. It's due out on May 8th. And I know 2000 AD are excited because it'll be coming out in time to promote their new Judge Dredd film. And and because it's also, is it the 35th anniversary?
35th, one year younger than me, yes.
Wow, you are old. 35th anniversary of 2000 AD. So it's set to be an amazing year for 2000 AD, and I'm really looking forward to this album as a fan of Portishead as well. So keep your ears peeled for that one. We'll be promoting it. We could review it when it comes out. Do you know that? We should do that.
We could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
I won't have much to say because I'm not a musical reviewer like yourself, aficionado, but I'll comment on the cover artwork and the liner notes. This CD is awesome. It fits in my CD player and everything.
Get on.
A couple of magazines. Bleeding Cool is releasing a magazine. Bleeding Cool is a website which Mammoth have been popular. Phil be spelling mistakes, but nonetheless, they seem to get a lot of exclusive news when it comes to especially comics and kind of doing investigative stuff. So Rich Johnston, who actually had the pleasure of meeting once, he's basically a blogger who's now doing it full-time. So if you go to bleedingcool.com, that's where you'll find a lot of comic news. But anyway, they're releasing a magazine, which is kind of surprising. So it debuts with a zero issue in late May, which is going to be launched at the Phoenix Comic Con, and then they're going to have the proper launch in October. The first issue will be in October. So the zero issue is $1.50, 32 pages of cover. So it's interesting that it's kind of coming from a website that's not known a lot for long articles and interviews and such. It's more a couple of paragraphs of rumors and stuff. But usually, I mean, it's not a gossip website, but go to bleedingcool.com, you'll know what I mean. But yes, so I mean, I hope it does well. Because I think when Rich Johnston, the founder of Bleeding Cool, does do investigative stuff, which usually he does about dodgy artists and why people aren't getting paid, he actually has got some good journalistic skills there. So it'll be interesting to see some longer articles. But
magazines about comics these days don't do very well. You have to offer some very exclusive content. And these days with the internet, offering exclusive content is very difficult to do.
Yes, and especially obviously the internet can do it a lot quicker.
And after the failure and collapse of now I can't remember the name.
Wizard,
thank you. I consider their content quite similar to Wizard in terms of the, I guess, the tone and approach and like the length of the articles. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully it'll be a success and we'll get to see comic-related magazines again on the shelves. As long as it's not just pictures of comic book films on the cover. I hate that.
True.
Yeah.
Well, I did mention Rations magazine a couple of weeks ago. So they've just released their first two issues, which you can get for free as PDFs, and they're pretty awesome. So, yeah, that's Rations magazine, which I think is also based in the UK. The other magazine, DC Comics, are launching it also in May, is based on their Cartoon Network block, which I think is starting this weekend, well, at least in America, the DC Nation Super Spectacular. So that's going to be basically, looks like, a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff, 64 pages for $5. But it's launched as a one-shot so far, and if it's successful, they're going to do more. But, yeah, it'll have, like, Green Lantern, Super Friends, that kind of stories. Basically, it's one of those kids' magazines. Alan Moore has had another rant.
Oh, I see what you did there. I thought you were going to talk about Alan Grant for a second.
Oh, yes.
No, not the Jurassic Park character, the comic book writer. You're listening to the wrong podcast if you confuse the two Alan Grants there. But go on. Sorry.
Yes, I haven't got any quotes here from Alan Moore, but he's, we know, before Watchmen, which is the Watchmen controversial prequel that is coming out in the next couple of months. And so Alan Moore has done another. He seems to be doing a lot more interviews in the last year than he has ever done before. But he's basically saying that, yeah, he's fallen out with Watchmen co-creator Dave Gibbons and what he thinks of the creators and the people that are buying. Basically, he doesn't like anyone involved with this before Watchmen project. But, yeah, we'll put a link if you want to read the whole lengthy interview about such things. I'm sure you'll be interested.
And he has a fine rebuttal for the usual tripe we hear from people like, well, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen uses other characters, so who are you to say? And then he has a pretty well-reasoned, I thought, response to that. I'm sure I'd just mangle it if I attempted it myself. But, yeah, you should go read the... if not the whole interview, at least the entertaining excerpts, because he has some amusing things to say also about how he and Gibbons were screwed over in their contracts with DC and the somewhat immoral things that the company did. Like sneaky little clauses and so forth. But it's good reading, folks. And don't believe everything you hear about Alan Moore. He seems like a nice self-deprecating guy. Tone's a hard thing to get across in an interview, though. I'm sure.
That's true. Yeah, I think it's easy to paint him kind of as the weirdo with the beardo or whatever. Yeah. Kind of lives in his castle and throws rocks at the peasants down below. But
and his writing is far more scathing. Like, you see him in spoken word interviews and he's sort of got this grin, like he's half joking when he's making these snarky comments. So remember that. Like, he is just being a little bit cheeky. So give him some slack, folks. Yeesh.
True, true. The other last thing that I want to mention was we talked about Jim Henson last week, creator of The Muppets and Sesame Street and a bunch of other things. The Henson Studios are releasing a film. I don't know when it's coming out, but it's called The Happy Time Murders. And so far all that's been released is a still, but it's basically set in a world where puppets exist alongside actual non-puppet people like you and I. And it's a kind of noir murder mystery where puppets are basically second-class citizens. And, the still was pretty interesting, wasn't it, Lukerton?
Yeah, it's a Muppet who's been killed. All his stuffing's been ripped out. He's been killed in like a Muppet sex shop. Well, it should be exciting either way. Obviously satirical, probably poking fun at CSI and so forth. And if there's any show that deserves to have holes poked in it, it's CSI. There's a sound effect whenever anyone finds a murder. Like, say if someone's drowned in a pool, then he might say, looks like he had a little too much to drink, and then the theme song kicks in.
So he might say, that's appalling behavior.
Very good.
He should have waited an hour after eating.
I can tell you've had a lot of creative writing experience. You're good at this. Put your sunglasses on, and let's get into this topic. Chris, what is this song? Why are we listening to this?
Oh, I didn't even get to the chorus. That is Annie Lennox from Eurythmics and Aretha Franklin, the soul queen herself, singing, "Sisters are doing it for themselves."
I had to get at least one in there, didn't I?
So, Yes.
Which should tell you what our topic is this week. It's female comic creators. This is a topic I enjoyed looking up, and I was surprised we haven't done it yet.
No, well, I think it's because we both are scared of
offending
females.
Oh, God.
Or is it just me?
Speak for yourself. I've been reluctant to do this topic because I feel like doing a whole show on female creators is a little bit wrong in itself, like they have to be separated in some way, which is not at all the case. We're doing this mostly as a chance, not that we ignore female creators in our usual show, but just as a fun way to showcase some of our favorite comic creators who have vaginas. How about that?
And also breasts.
There's no subtext. No, they don't have to have breasts, Chris. Don't be pigeonholing people. This is why I didn't want to do this topic, because you're just not a progressive male, a 21st century male. You're a dinosaur.
Like Alan Grant. So, yes, one of the things we quickly found was that most female creators are, I mean, we want to kind of focus on writers / artists.
Yeah.
Slashies. Not slashies, but slashies, like models / actress.
Do you have to refer to vaginas with every sentence?
I wasn't.
Women slashes are not something we want to talk about on podcast.
You're a sick man and you need help. So we are going to be talking about a few OGMs, original graphic novels. I've got a handful, and I know you also do too. And, there's quite a long list. So,
Well, we've got our favourites, you know, and then we've got some who I guess we're just familiar with and haven't read as much as we should. And, I mean, it's a wide world. I guess just in broad terms, maybe we could just talk about, trends we've noticed. Because I don't really want to say that there's any kind of women write like this, men write like this, because I've sort of found that's not really the case at all. Women write in all sorts of ways. What I have seen is the type of media they're working in, because mainstream comics are kind of they're known for being a bit of a boys' club, and there's quite a few female creators working in, I guess, mainstream superhero comics, and we can mention some of those in a minute. But, I mean, female comic creators, I don't know if it's – maybe it's just because a lot of them are so kind of idiosyncratic that they just prefer to work on their own creations, like most independent comic artists. And you see female comic creators are very active in webcomics, almost much more so than male webcomic creators, which is an interesting trend. But, yeah, they are kind of horrifically underrepresented in mainstream comics in the new DC 52 and so forth. Let's open with, some female comic writers.
Right off the top of the bat, I did want to quickly mention a book that I read this week, which is by Gestalt, and that's actually by two female creators, and Opatowski and Aya Morton. So that's actually up Maya Orton. One of those.
What?
I don't have the book with me. Walled City, His Dream of the Skyland, book one. So that's actually by two female creators. Mm. But I just want to mention that you can see my review up at Broken Frontier. One I did read this week was Tamara Drew. Now, that's the name of the book, not the artist. Tamara Drew is by Posy Stimmons, and you might remember the 2010 film starring the rather somewhat attractive, I would say, Gemma Arterton, who was in one of the Bond films, Casino Royale.
Yeah, and she was terrible in Prince of Persia.
She died in that. Yes.
Really bad.
So, Jake Gyllenhaal, when he became buff. Tamara Drew was a comic strip that she ran in a newspaper from 2005 to 2007, and I picked up the TPB, the trade paper, collecting said strip for $5. So it's actually pretty good. It's basically set in a retreat in the English countryside called Stonefield, which is a retreat for writers, and it's run by this lady, Beth, and her husband, Nicholas, who's also a writer, but he's got writer's block, and he's missed the deadlines for the first time in his life, and basically his husband discovers that he's been having an affair. So it basically looks into the lives of all the other writers that are around. So there's this guy called Glenn, who's a uni lecturer, and he's taken Tom off. It's interesting because he kind of feels uneasy about all the comfort, and he expects writers to kind of live in squalor, or the muse kind of won't call. But it's kind of like, as a drama, it's very well-paced. It's kind of filled with kind of very interesting characters and the way they intermingle with one another, and that all gets upset by the arrival of said titular character, Tamara. and the effect that she has on the men and women in this kind of tight community. Is this a book that you've been aware of or a film that you've seen at all?
I've never heard of this. In fact, when you said it, I thought of Nancy Drew. So, no, I'm sorry.
I think it's got definitely, this one's got an E on the end. Maybe they're related. But yeah, Tamara's actually a newspaper columnist and she had a nose job recently, so she's kind of alluring and sexy. And it's interesting, Glenn says, and I wrote this quote down as I want to do, it's weird talking to her. You think she's coming on to you. She aims this scorching look and you're transfixed with lust. I'm not kidding, but she's kidding. It's as if she has an erotic stun gun and you're just target practice, just her bit of fun raising the hopes of old fatsoes like me. Really insulting when I think about it. So it's interesting to kind of, she's just kind of dropped like a bomb and has all the effect on all the people around her. So there's kind of the drama and the gossip, but the dialogue is very real. And the way it's set up is an artistic exercise is pretty interesting. It's basically a combination of just diary excerpts, I guess, from each different character. So each of the character kind of has their own kind of plots running and the way they interact with each other and Tamara. And then it's got excerpts of like Tamara's column, websites, magazine interviews, that kind of thing. But it's kind of got this washed, watercolored kind of approach to the art. There's a bit of nudity because there's a bit of sexiness in here. But, yeah, it all seems very real, like the dialogue and stuff and kind of showing life on the countryside. So, so that's Tamara Drew by Posy Simmons. And I think I might actually give this to my mum.
Oh.
I think she'd like it. It's actually a really good-looking book and quite easy to read. I like kind of the real dialogue and kind of characters like that. So
you like when books are easy to read. You don't.
Well, you know, like it's kind of it's real and it's very dialogue driven and all the people seem real. They're not melodramatic and like their thoughts in the head and what they actually say to themselves and say to each other. And it actually winner of the Grand Prix 2009 de la Critique Ben Dessany. So there you go.
Much
on French Award in 2009.
That's very good. I'm impressed. Since we're just doing this in any old stupid order, I'll start with Carla Speed McNeil. Now,
yes,
this may not be a name that's familiar to too many, which is a shame. Finder is the series she's most famous for, and it's been published since 1996, first as a physical copy and is now turned into a web comic just because of the prohibitive costs of putting out weekly comics, and then they're collected into trade paperbacks, which is a pretty
good... I think it's also in Dark Horse Presents. I think it might be serialized.
Yeah.
In Dark Horse Presents Anthology.
That's right. They've been putting out the big new collections of it as well. So now's a good time to catch up on this series as well. As a comic, it's kind of this, it's a science fiction story, which is a blend of kind of tribalism and proto-spiritualistic ideas with speculative science fiction. So it explores kind of the...
There's a lot of big words in that sentence.
Thank you. I'm here all week. It looks at the restraints of society and class, and there's a really strong focus on family and societal roles, which is usually how these stories play out. There's very few comics I can point to which... Even in, especially in science fiction, actually, where the family is the core unit of the story, and there's a recurring family in this story, the Lockharts, who a lot of the stories center around, as well as a character called Jaeger, who's a bit of a Wolverine-esque loner type. So it's not all female characters, but it's great because he's written as eye candy, which I found kind of funny and refreshing because it's like, well, yeah, why not? Why not be, you know, obvious about it? Because at least she's not a closeted, Jim Lee homosexual, you know, drawing buff nude men and all this. Anyway, but it's a really I find it a really enjoyable comic. Really kind of naturalistic dialogue for a science fiction story. I'm wondering if that's going to be a recurring theme in some of the comics we talk about tonight. But Finder's a great series to pick up, especially now, and it's kind of very highly regarded science fiction comic. So,
I've been familiar with it, but I've read very little of it. But yeah, it does get rave reviews. Mm. But I guess, I mean, a lot of the female artists do kind of have the natural dialogue and tend to have strong female characters or relatable female characters in their book, which is natural. I know I've read writers where like the male writers will ask for advice from their wives or whatever, like how would women react in this, you know, like that kind of stuff, for a bit of insight. So I guess it's just the writing what you know. But yeah, it's been much in the same way that guys, I guess, tend to write a lot of guy characters.
Well, that's not, I mean, in Finder, I mean, there's quite a few more characters, but there's also quite a few male characters, and they all ring true as well. And I don't know if it's a case of going up to her boyfriend or whatever. What would a man do in this situation? I'm sort of wondering, but it's not like they're, you know, women with penises. Like the, you know, you sometimes read a comic and it's just a dude talking, but they've got boobs. Like, it just doesn't ring true for some reason. But maybe it's not men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Maybe we're more similar than we think under pressure of a science fiction scenario. And another science fiction one I thought I just mentioned because they group together quite nicely is Colleen Doran.
Yep.
Who's probably most well known for A Distant Soil, which her comics has been ongoing since 1983, I think, and has outlasted three publishers, and it's currently being put out by Image. But she's a long-time illustrator-writer. She's worked with Neil Gaiman, Peter David, J. Michael Straczynski, Anne Rice, a few others. But the comic itself, it's a science fiction story about a girl who's born as the heir to this alien dynasty and the powers that are with there. So it's a nice blend of kind of some superhero tropes of the early 80s, I guess, with science fiction. But that's another one which has its own kind of idiosyncratic view. Yeah.
Cool.
Give me one of yours. Shoot.
One that we both had, and I'm a big fan of this lady, Faith Erin Hicks. The first book I read of hers was maybe 2-3 years ago, called Zombies Calling. It's the first book of hers I read. She publishes mainly 3 first-second books, black and white digests done in one kind of series. So she hasn't really had, I don't think she's done anything for Marvel or DC. She's kind of one of those solo creators. I've pretty much picked up everything she's done since kind of falling in love with the works with Zombies Calling. They all have great art, great dialogue. I think fans of Scott Pilgrim, I like her work. She's got that kind of manga light kind of artwork, but all the characters look very different. And you notice the fashion in all her books as well. Well, she must read Marie Claire magazine or whatever. Like, it all seems very realistic. She writes a lot of kind of teens, and yeah, pretty much all of her books have teen protagonists, usually girls. But yeah, it's really good. So she's actually got a webcomic as well called The Adventures of Superhero Girl, which is actually on hiatus until June, but anyway. And she did a 4-page Hunger Games adaptation, which just got her a bit of positive press in the last couple of weeks. But yeah, so I've got 3 books of hers that I wanted to mention. The first one actually is co-written by a guy, but I want to mention it anyway. It's written by Susan Kim and Lawrence Clavin, with art by Faith Erin Hicks. It's called Brain Camp. And it's published by First Second, and it's set in Camp Fielding, which is basically a camp for slacker teens to go and learn lots of skills and be nice. So Jenna and Lucas, and there's 2 slackers who go, and they see that all the kids around, and they start acting like weird, kind of like intelligent zombies, kind of, if you know what I mean. So they basically find this big conspiracy. So it's kind of horror light, like it's safe for kids, but it's got some gross moments. But yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I will say that I enjoyed it less than the work that she does her own. But the interesting thing is that this is actually in colour as well. I think the first book of hers in colour. The other one I read was The War at Ellesmere. This is from 2008, I believe, and it basically centres on another teen girl called Juniper. She goes to this kind of prestigious boarding school called Ellesmere Academy. She's poor, so she goes there on a scholarship, and then she kind of befriends Cassie, who has kind of absent parents. So these two get picked on by the rich girls a lot, and so it's kind of interesting. Like, Emily is this kind of snobby rich girl who kind of picks on these two, and she's got like these 2 sidekicks who are going like, they kind of roll their eyes at her megalomania and paranoia. But yeah, there's kind of an interesting sequence that's very fantasy driven, and kind of, it's kind of hard to explain. I think fans of Harry Potter will like it. Again, it's great art. She just gets better with each book. Kind of like, as I said, Scott Pilgrim, but a lot more detailed and more realistic. Like, she doesn't really do the blank backgrounds thing, like all the architecture, as I said, the fashion. It's all very rendered in such a great style, and even though it's kind of black and white with grey tones, it's, yeah, well, I'll try and put some preview pages up online, or at least links to kind of tell what I'm talking about. But, yeah, so that's The War at Ellesmere. That's soap opera, but not really melodramatic, and there's like a great kind of sequence where Cassie is recounting the history of Ellesmere to Juniper. It's like an old castle, and there's like two old brothers, and there's like a white deer in the forest. So it's got hints of fantasy, but done in a subtle way, and it never overrides the story. So she kind of does the stuff that you could just hand to, you know, that would be safe in the library bookshelf, or, you know, you could hand to your nieces or nephews, or it's kind of all ages, kid-friendly, easy to read in one sitting. You're all familiar with her work, I think, aren't you?
I remember Demonology 101. I'm not so familiar with anything else she's done, to my shame. But I know she's been working as an animator in the recent years. I didn't know how many more comics she was working on at the moment. So it's good to know she has so many under her belt. So that's excellent.
Yes, well, the last one I've read of hers, the last one I mentioned, is Friends with Boys. That came out, I think, last month, actually. It actually started as a webcomic, and then when the print version came out, again, by First Second, they took down the print version. But you can still see the first 20 pages of the preview online. It's 120 page original graphic novel published by First Second, and was originally a pitch for the Minx imprint, M-I-N-X imprint, which was... It was DC Comics. Was it their female creator-centered imprint? Is that what it was?
Yeah, a few years ago, I can talk in more detail on it, but Minx was their attempt to give female creators, and titles for teenage girls was also the what they were aiming for. Yep. So they had Brian Wood was writing a few of the books, so it wasn't all, and male creators were on it as well. I think it was aimed at female audiences, so that was their intent. And then they dropped it very quickly after it didn't.
Yeah, it didn't last too long, did it?
Yeah, they didn't see it through, I think, long enough, which is a shame. But sorry, go on.
But yeah, this is, I really liked this book. Again, it's very, I guess, like Tamara Drew, and this is a theme I'm noticing, as I mentioned, it's got that kind of real dialogue. Again, like it's a lot of back, not kind of witty, not like Josh Whedon or Kevin Smith characters where everyone's kind of witty, yeah. But it's very real and emotional, and kind of Faith Erin Hicks, she does tend to, I guess, use a lot of the same kind of character tropes, like there's kind of outcast girls go to a new school or something, and then they kind of discover the world around them, and so that kind of shows back and forth. But each book is very distinctive, regardless of that kind of broad strokes that are used with each book. So, yeah, Friends with Boys I really liked. It basically focuses on Maggie. She's been homeschooled for her whole life, just like her three brothers before her. And it basically picks up to her first day in high school. So this is the first day that she's ever not been homeschooled. On her way, she walks through a cemetery and meets a silent ghost that we eventually learn has been in her life for years and years and just shows up every now and then and doesn't really talk to her. Her dad is the new police chief. He has to get his hair cut because he looks like a bit of a hippie. So it's got lots of little kind of things like that. Maggie becomes... friends with these outsiders, Lucy and Alistair, who are siblings and basically just punk kids. He's got like a bit of half a mohawk kind of thing. We learn that Alistair used to hang out with a popular volleyball team captain until they had a falling out. But it's interesting, every character in here is very well-rounded. Like Maggie, her taste, like she likes Alien, and her friend Lucy loves Patti Smith, you know, kind of unusual taste for two teenage high schoolers. They go to a maritime museum and they talk about the history of the area. There's a school musical about zombies. Fantastic art, again, like really fantastic art, just done with black, white and grey tones. Just very detailed. There's some just amazing silent pages where Maggie is basically just walking around the cemetery and then she's walking around the town by herself. Just does architecture very well and just school and, yeah, it's like a lot of artists kind of skimp on that stuff, but, I mean, she tends to release like one of these original graphic novels one every year or so, so you can see why it takes her so long. But, yeah, I think if you like Scott Pilgrim, I think you'll like this. It's kind of got that great mix of kind of drama, romance, finding yourself, the kind of realistic friends, socialising, all that kind of stuff. Great fashion. The characters all look identifiable and different from one another. even though she does a lot of her books use, you know, teenage girls as a protagonist, every book you won't get the characters confused amongst them. So yeah, that's Friends with Boys, and yeah, it's certainly my favourite Faith Herring Hicks book thus far. So I do want to give a shout out to her because she's doing some fantastic work.
That was like a gushing 10 minutes of Faith.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, wow.
Well, I guess she doesn't get a lot of
that's
press,
true.
Like,
yeah.
And especially when you're not working for Marvel or DC, and First Second aren't a huge publisher, so they can kind of tend to fly under the radar.
But as
somebody
new?
Who doesn't read web comics, I've followed her career, glad.
Because their deal is they usually serialize online and then publish in print. Didn't they recently do one which was about a Harry Potter-esque book? I think it's called Secondus. Did you read that one?
Are you talking about First Second?
Yeah, it's one of their books.
Doesn't sound familiar. Secondus?
Secondus.
How do I spell that? That was really nice dessert. Can I go back to the Secondus?
Yeah. Let's move on. okay, well, speaking of web cartoonists, I just wanted to drop it. And she does not need any more press, this person I'm about to mention, but Kate Beaton, and I'm a bit sick of talking about her because everyone's like, ooh, Kate Beaton this. Probably because, like, she's, you know, quite a unique and funny web cartoonist. You might have seen her comic Harker Vagrant online. It's kind of difficult to avoid, and she's gone on a hiatus now while she's working on a... Finally, in a full-length, you know, graphic novel story, and it's about freaking time. She's hit striking while the iron is hot, which is nice, but she's got a very, and I'm using this word a lot tonight, idiosyncratic sense of humor. Very absurdist, and she always she approaches these not obscure, but not the obvious historical events. So she'll pick a minor historical figure from Canadian political history and spin out these amazingly funny stories about that, like based in research of this person's life and bizarre things that would have happened because they had this strange attitude towards whatever. And I just find her very enjoyable. Anyone who's a fan of history and strange little stories through history, her comic is a always a source of humorous, like hoity-toity laughter, because it's drawn in almost in a hoity-toity way. But it's a fun one, Harker Vagrant. I'll quickly move few more of these. You mentioned Minx earlier,
yes,
which was DC's half-assed attempt to...
I believe that's the quote they use for the press release.
Yeah. Our half-assed attempt to shut you broads up. Here you go. You can't say we're sexist now, women. But Karen Berger, I know, was involved with like trying to spearhead Minx. I don't think she was being supported by the company. I felt we really needed to mention her because she's the longtime executive editor of really what I think is DC's most interesting thing about it, which is the Vertigo imprint. Ever since its inception, she was there before, like keeping that kind of story work alive. And it's interesting because in Alan Moore's recent interview, he described Vertigo as DC's attempt to farm Alan Moore's to hire writers who would write in a similar way. And I sort of get where he's coming from because a lot of those early Vertigo books did attempt that. But she, as an editor, has such a specific vision of you know, what this line should be and how it should work. It's nice to see one of the most influential editors in mainstream comics is a woman. And it's worth mentioning just because I don't think enough people talk about her. She's kind of behind the... It's like an insider thing, so not everyone's even aware of this person who kind of runs things a lot. Moving on, just mentioning a few others. Sophie Crumb, not just known as like riding on the coattails of her famous comic alt comics father Robert Crumb, she's also well recognized herself as an underground artist. You've got Jill Thompson, who has a very particular style, very recognizable. She's worked on Sandman and others, and
Beasts of Burden. That's her, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, and. Becky Cloonan, who rose to prominence as the artist on Demo, which was Brian Wood's breakout success, and they've been working together a fair bit. She's
currently doing Conan.
Yeah, that's right. The Conan mini Something of the Seas. I can't remember the name of it now.
Queen of the Black Seas. Issue 2 is now out from Dark Horse Comics and your local neighborhood comic retailer.
Amazing. She's also worked on Northlanders and a few others as well. But her style, I really love her artwork. It's very sleek and kind of sharp and really confident inking, which works best, I think, in black and white. But she's one who has a very... You can pick her artwork straight away. There's nothing that in it that really you could confuse with anyone else's, I think. She's just got her own vision, I suppose. One which is quite different to that, I guess, also works in black and white, is Marianne Satrapi. Now, this is the Iranian-French writer-artist of who's most well-known for Persepolis, so, and that's the work I know best of hers as well. But I've noticed she's kind of woefully underread by mainstream comics fans. Mm. Is that something you've experienced?
Yes. Well, yeah, when I hear her name, I just think Persepolis. I've actually never read it, but I've actually got the DVD from Quick Flix, so it actually arrived today, but I didn't get time to watch it before.
Watch
this,
it. It's probably my favourite comic book adaptation of any.
Wow, comic. Better than Ghost Rider.
Even better than Melbourne's Ghost Rider. But Persepolis is her two-volume work from the year 2000. It tells stories of her upbringing and flight from Iran during the war with Iraq and the country's shift from what was, a liberal... becoming a modern country in the 70s and then turned very quickly into a highly religious, conservative country and the reforms there, which were quite dangerous, I suppose, and that led to her parents sending her off to grow up in Europe, and she doesn't quite fit in anywhere. When she comes back to Iran, she's too metropolitan to fit in there. But as a piece of a person's particular vision of what it was like to grow up in a country which a lot of us in the West aren't very familiar with, you know, what it's like day to day living in Iran. It's kind of an honest, kind of eye-opening look at, you know, how other people live, and a main character who's kind of feisty but a little bit callous, and she's honest and points out certain flaws that she has which work against her in certain key scenes. But so many wonderful little vignettes of her life in this book. I really love this story, and as you mentioned, there's an animated film of it which is freaking fantastic. But this book is also the favourite of a close friend that you and I share, who had a similar upbringing to Marianne Satrapi. So,
yes, you're right. Yes.
Yeah. And it's one of those comics which has been a breakout hit. I think it's more widely read by people outside of the comics community than within it, which is a shame in one sense, but it's I'm super happy that this is the ambassador of, you know, well, I guess of European kind of comics more so, I suppose, but the ambassador of where comics are going, because it's fantastic work. So, yeah, that's one. We should have kicked ourselves if we didn't mention her.
So, too true.
I've got several more, but I'll pass it over to you, the torch.
Oh, okay. Like they do in the Olympics. Well, the last one, a specific book I wanted to mention was Emmytown Volume 2. I think we talked about Volume 1 last year, which is basically the sketch diary of a young comics artist, Emmy Lennox.
Not Annie Lennox.
What?
Not Annie Lennox.
No, sisters. this is her diary. Covers May 2010 to April 2011. But basically, again, yeah, it's a webcomic that is now published in actual paper format. Wow, man. So it's got an intro by a former Image PR guy and now writer of a comic I mentioned last week, Hell Yeah, Joe Keating. And they actually met over 10 years ago working together at a video store, and they're still friends, and he pops up in her diary. But it's actually interesting. She kind of admits that she was actually quite shy about sharing her artistic tendencies to the people around her, but they basically encouraged her to do so, and then she put it online, and then she went public and kind of got picked up an Image. So now she's done work for Sweet Tooth for Vertigo and Mad Men for Image as well. So it's good. And this volume of her life over the year, over the course of her life. You can see her confidence building, and she's very honest, and you can see opportunities to make a living from comics kind of presented to her, so it's pretty interesting. Her art is kind of that cute, over-expressive manga kind of influenced art where, you know, everyone's got small eyes and big mouths. So not Scott Pilgrim or Faith Erin Hicks, but a lot more simpler than that. Mm. It's black and white, or rather kind of purple or grey and white. But it's basically every day is different, and each page is it's either like one event or a series of different random occurrences that have happened to her. Mm. And basically normal daily stuff that we all go through. But
they're quite amusing simple when it's events, portrayed aren't like they? This. It's not like Marion Satrapi's very specific, interesting upbringing. It's just kind of, I guess, closely observed conversations and strange encounters with friends and that kind of thing. So
stuff that would be a couple of minute scenes in Seinfeld episode or something like that. Stuff, for example, hanging out with their other comic professionals in this story. It doesn't really have dialogue and stuff, basically just her thoughts about what happens. Mm. But it's one of those dip-in books that makes it a breeze to read. There's a scene where she goes to a Daniel Clowes signing and kind of freaks out about giving him her mini comics. She hangs out with James Dean. He's dead.
She's a time traveling cartoonist.
What? She's what?
She's a time traveling cartoonist.
Yes, that's the best kind.
Copyright. Yep.
She tries to kill a spider by jabbing it with some paper towel. That's pretty funny. And then occasionally she'll have like visual interpretations of the songs that she's been listening to, or films or TV shows that she's been watching. For instance, the similarities between Avatar and Dances with Wolves. Or she'll illustrate the dreams. Stuff like that. She does it in a more detailed style, which is kind of awesome. And I wish she'd do a whole book like that. Like, it's not as cartoony as the bulk, like 80-90% of this book is.
It reads like a comic blog in a way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So like there's a pretty funny sequence where she's wishing she had an iPhone while she waits in bars for her friends outside while they smoke, or what a dog Henry gets up to, her love of Dakota Fanning, and then she loses her job. She has this burgeoning romance with this guy Tim that carries on through as kind of a narrative through the second half of the book. It does kind of suffer from the same things that I think we both mentioned in volume one, where we know what she does but we don't really know her. I still don't know what her job is after reading 2 years of her life. We know nothing about Tim, who's the guy that comes into her life. But I will say that it's very honest about her romance, and I can't really say any more than that without spoiling it. But it's all very relatable. Again, there's that word again. There's a few spelling mistakes, like the first volume, but not many. But this is a book that's not going to be for everybody. It never comes across as self-indulgent. And I think she's presented herself well, like she's not some kind of flighty, "Oh, here's a random thought that I come into mind, isn't it funny? She seems like quite a real person, and quite a person who's just kind of struggling. You know, she's poor and, you know, she's hungry, and this is the food she likes, and she's getting along with her parents, that kind of stuff. It's very real, Maladin. So, I mean, I'd be interested to see how many volumes of this, of Emmy Town, she can continue to do, but I think, I think most people will find at least something to like in this. And I've got to applaud her honesty, especially in the last half of the book, for sure.
Hmm. So for fans of Marvel Civil War, pick up Emmy Town.
I mean, look, if you like the kind of autobiographical comics, this isn't one. This isn't, you know, like dialogue-heavy Kevin Smith melodramatic film. This is a kind of
quite light.
Something you can dip into. Very light reading. Mm. Maybe not so much of the second half. But enjoyable nonetheless. And she really does have a really good, easy on the eyes art style. And I, you know, she's got some definite talent, the way she kind of takes a snapshot of
such
what's
a sexist. She's got talent. Gams.
hopefully she can also included in here is the couple of pages that she did with Jeff Lemire on his comic, where the character kind of falls in a tent or something and goes to Emmy Town, which is kind of good to see the art styles clashing. Hopefully she can get more work, and because you do kind of feel for it, you do kind of feel empathy towards her, because she's just kind of a young, kind of struggling artist trying to make it through life. So you're kind of cheering her on as you read this book, you know. Yeah. Go, Remy. I liked it.
Cool. I'll try and breeze through the last ones on my list, heading over to the Orient, as it hasn't been called since 1895. Quite a few female manga artists are currently working there and have created very successful properties. So they're successful in the mainstream. And Naoko Takeuchi created Sailor Moon, and we know what a huge hit that's been over its many incarnations. Natsuki Takaya came up with Fruits Basket. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but that's a...
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's another kind of high school shoujo romance, quirky little title. Ryoko Ikeya did Rose of Versailles, which has a very... Art Nouveau kind of Aubrey Beardsley look to it. It's kind of this particular style which hasn't been done much since, I guess, in terms of what we've seen translated into the West. Maybe it is still popular there, but, you know, we can only dip into what we can find here, which is a shame. But one I sort of has been a breakout hit, a huge hit for male and female audiences everywhere, I guess, is Hiromu Arakawa's Full Metal Alchemist. And I'm sure this is a title you've heard of. It's one of the most popular manga and anime of all time right now, really. Yeah. And that kind
of... by a woman. I didn't know that.
Yeah, this was news to me as well. It's just because the central two characters are a pair of brothers who are in this fantasy blend of fantasy and kind of late 18th century kind of... not cyberpunk... what's the
steampunk?
Old? Steampunk, thank you, kind of look. But it's the kind of dynamic between them works really well. And for some reason, I never realized it was a female writer, but probably because I'm not so familiar with Japanese names. Hiromu, what's that? I don't know. Male, female, whatever. But I thought we could end maybe by sending a bit of love to female Australian cartoonists, because we are an Australian comic podcast. You've got Nicola Scott, who works mainly right now in mainstream American comics. She's from Sydney. This was news to me. But she notably has worked on Secret Six and Birds of Prey. I don't know if she's got any titles with them now. I don't think she has.
Yeah, she's doing the, I think written by James Robinson, she's doing the Earth 2 series, which is part of the new DC 52, which I think launches in May.
Yeah, I noticed she was absent from the roster for the new DC, and possibly because she's been working on this graphic novel thing. So at least we know there was a reason why they'd left her out, because people were like, why would you not include Nicola Scott? Nikki Greenberg is from Melbourne. She might not be so well-known to comics fans. Her two books have been huge hits, I guess, in the book scene. Her adaptations of The Great Gatsby and Hamlet, published by Allen and Unwin. So she's got a very psychedelic approach, very colourful, detailed backgrounds with starkly chiaroscuro black and white characters who are very kind of talking animal-ish. It's a strange kind of look, but it really works. It's very expressive. And both of those books have garnered quite a few awards and should be more well-read, I suppose. You've got... Katie Horton Ward, and she's a spectacular artist. She's been illustrating for 12 years. I guess she's known for her work on Arsenic Lullaby and her comic Kulan, which is appearing in the American Heavy Metal, I believe. So there's that one. And I think she's publishing something with 2000 AD right now. So that's fantastic. Sarah Howell is part of Squishface Studio, who are a comic studio who just opened up in Melbourne as well. But she's heavily involved in the art scene here, and was a 2009-2010 co-director of the National Young Writers Festival, and is currently working on a couple of comics, one about Dame Enid Lyons, the first female federal member of parliament, and Harold 007 Holt, that's how she describes him. He's the prime minister who...
was kidnapped by the Russians in a submarine. Yeah.
That's the theory. Who mysteriously disappeared when he went out swimming one day. So either he was murdered by unionists or eaten by a shark, or as you mentioned, he was recalled to Mother Russia to await further instruction. So
apparently those further instructions include staying dormant for decades.
And then finally, the Labour Party is left without a leader. Who will step up? Harold Holt walks out of the ocean. But hopefully the book will reveal the secret behind Harold Holt. But there's that to look forward to. I believe that's coming out either start of next year or end of this. Maybe I just pulled that out of my ass. I don't know. But But that's a, I guess, a reasonable cross-section of female comic creators. I'm sure we've missed...
We have. Can I include some?
Yes.
Did we mention Gail Simone? No. Writer Gail Simone?
OMG, we did not.
Birds of Prey, Batgirl, currently writing Batgirl. Catherine Eminem, who often works with her husband, Stewie, otherwise known professionally as Stewart. They're actually working together on May's Avenging Spider-Man number 7, where Spider-Man teams up with She-Hulk. So there you go. Marjorie Liu, Devon Grayson, Trina Robbins, I don't think we mentioned her, G. Willow Wilson, who did Air for Vertigo. Amanda Connor, another penciler mainly for DC, did the Power Girl series. Colleen Coover, can't remember if we mentioned her. And Louise Simonson, who had a lot of hand in the Superman series as a writer in the 90s. So yeah, there's quite a few. When you actually think about it, I guess mainly the kind of we've talked about quickly the writers and the artists, but there's also we gave a few examples of people that are both. So yeah, pick them up.
Yeah,
all of them that we've mentioned.
Pick all of them up. Well, hopefully there's something in there that sparked your interest. I guess it's not like unfairly that I guess these days it's pretty easy for male or female writer artists to get work put out there, but it's nice to take a second and kind of just be sexist, but in the opposite way, and only look at female creators just for one episode. Just for one episode, Chris, because we're never going to do a male comic creators episode, are we? No.
No. Quite a lot of these artists, writers and or artists that we've mentioned today contributed to Marvel's three-issue anthology series called Girl Comics that came out in 2010. So if you do like that, you can pick up the trade paperback, and if you see someone's work, one of the ladies' work in there that you like, then obviously you can follow them online. But yeah, and if you have any that we have missed, please let us know on Facebook.
And you can all look forward to the Womanthology anthology that's coming out, which was one of the most successful Kickstarter comic book campaigns of all time. So that's fantastic. So there you go. Fair few little reading items there. And hopefully we got away without making any crude remarks or...
I believe we carried ourselves with decorum and panache.
Very good.
In equal measure. Check us out on Facebook. We put news on there sometimes, especially this week. I think you and I have kind of done a flurry of activity, so sometimes the news that we don't always mention every week on the show, we'll put stuff up during the week on our Facebook page. Befriend us if you haven't already and contribute to the ongoing conversations that we sometimes have there. Email us if you like at chris@extrasequential.com. And I think next week, young Lucaton, we will probably have another prize. I'll put up clues on Facebook probably in the next couple of days after this issue episode is online. So keep your eyes peeled a banana for that.
Because if this week's prize is anything like the last prize pack you gave out, there was some gold material in there, including a copy of Demo, which we mentioned earlier in the show. But that's not this week's prize. That's
no. Well, this I can tell you. Do you want me to tell you what some of the
you
items
can give us hints? You know, give us little loaded hints.
I won't give you hints, but I'll tell you what is in the prize.
That's a hint.
Well, I'll tell you two non-comics items are in the prize.
Okay. Yeah.
The novelization of The Dark Knight. And a audio CD of, I think it's Infinite Crisis, if I'm not mistaken.
So if you
and a whole bunch of comics as well.
So if you like The Dark Knight but thought it was over too quickly and you want to savour that experience over the course of like a few days, the novelisation will tide you
out. And it's written by Denny O'Neill, so there you go.
What?
Yeah.
That's unusual. Okay, wow.
Writer and editor, so there you go.
Very cool. So there's that to look forward to. Keep an eye out for that, my friends.
And you are writing for Fine Mag, and music is at purgeaudit.com, I believe.
Hey, you're good at this. And you didn't mention that you write Comic Book Jesus and also for Broken Frontier.
I do.
Yes. So people should check out Chris's writing there. And make sure to call him out on any spelling mistakes. He loves that. Very good. Next week we'll be talking about bizarre character team-ups.
Yes.
The unexpected characters you never wanted or hoped would end up together, and we'll be getting into a few funny, you know, laugh out loud examples of that. So there's that to look forward to. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk at you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye now. Have a good week. Okay, then.